You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good afternoon, everybody. If we can get started, thank you all for coming to Brookings today. My name is Homi Karas. I'm the Deputy Director of the Global Economy and Development Program here at Brookings. So this afternoon, the topic for our discussion is aid effectiveness and, perhaps more importantly, what can be done to improve it. The story perhaps starts really starts about 6 years ago at Paris when donors and partner countries agreed to a set of targets and commitments to improve the effectiveness of aid. And importantly, they put in place a monitoring mechanism, which was basically a survey to assess progress. And they introduced commitments that were time-bound, quantitative in their nature, and with a cutoff date of 2010. So here we are today, and we're extremely fortunate to have the chairman of the Development Assistance Committee of the OECD to present a new report with the findings of that most recent survey about how we did against the targets that were established in 2005. So the report makes for very interesting reading. I believe that there were copies outside. I hope some of you might have got it. Certainly there were copies of the executive summary, which has some of the key findings there. But I would urge all of you who are interested in this topic to take a close look at the report, because there's a wealth of information in there. Perhaps I should add there's also a report which is an independent evaluation of the Paris Declaration, which was also prepared for the DAC. And I think in combination, these things are now really a treasure trove of material on how to improve aid. So the first thing I'd like to do, actually, is to commend the Development Assistance Committee for their willingness to put in place a transparent process from which lessons can be learned and from which we can hopefully make improvements for the future. And I think that that's something that's really been lacking in the aid world. And we've had any number of debates about whether aid is working or it's not working. And those debates have not really led to any conclusions. And now I think we've got a much more solid evidence base. And I hope that in the panel discussion that we will have, that will follow Brian's presentation, we'll turn to the forward-looking question of, well, now that we have all this evidence, what does it all mean? So we've got a very distinguished panel. I'll introduce them individually as we get to that part of the discussion. But I hope that you'll find that they'll bring perspectives, different perspectives on how this process is actually working on the ground to deliver better development, how it's working to deliver better partnerships, and how we can organize ourselves in the future to do even better. Now, there's one short change to the program that you have that I have to announce. One of our panelists, KY Amoako from Ghana, has unfortunately been taken sick. And so will not be able to join us today. And I'm particularly sorry about that, because KY was instrumental in putting together the partner country perspectives for the Accra Agenda for Action, which is also part of this process. So as we talk about the Paris survey, I think it's important for you to understand that the Paris survey is actually one of the key pieces of evidence that's going to be put before delegates to the Busan High-Level Forum on Aid Effectiveness that will take place in November. So this survey sheds light on some quite tough issues, like how does mutual accountability work in practice, what are some of the political and technical aspects of aid, use of country systems, ability and willingness of donors to coordinate among themselves. So you'll hear a lot about this, but as you listen to this presentation, I think you should also keep in mind some things that the Paris Monitoring Survey does not do and that was never intended to do, but which are important to the discussions on aid effectiveness going forward in Busan. So importantly, the Paris process does not cover private aid providers, although it did seek their views. It does not include the participation of many emerging donors, like China and India, who did not sign on to the Paris Declaration. It doesn't look more broadly at development results, but focuses much more specifically on aid. And I think that as we go into Busan and into a discussion of the new thinking about the role of aid, we have to look both to these results about the achievements of the Paris Declaration, but then also think about what lessons we can learn from the process that will help us incorporate these other issues. So I'd now like to turn the floor over to Brian Atwood. Brian is the chairman of the OECD's Development Assistance Committee since January of this year. He spent 8 years before that as dean of the Hubert Humphrey School of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota. And before that, he was the president and CEO of Citizens International, an innovative new venture establishing public-private partnerships to help build democratic market systems. He was also the administrator of the U.S. Agency for International Development during the Clinton administration. Brian, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you very, very much. And I take note every time that I'm introduced that the introduction takes a little longer as I get older, and I appreciate very much your kind words, Homi. I want to just share with you that Homi Karas is a source of a lot of good ideas, and I had the opportunity yesterday to speak to the Development Committee of the G20, and I think it's fairly obvious that there has to be a very strong link between the G20 and what happens at Busan and what happens within the development community writ large, which is the rest of the world. There are several suggestions that Homi and a group made just a few weeks ago about, you know, what kind of structure should exist after Busan. And those were taken on board and will be considered by the working party in a few weeks. And I'm delighted that the chair of the working party here, Talat Abdel-Malik, is here to talk more about that process. Emily Pires, the Minister of Finance from Timor, is here as well. And I can't tell you how important it has been through the international dialogue that we've established with some of the lower-income, fragile states to see the leadership that has come from those countries. And I think that's kind of the story behind the report that we issued today. I want to discuss this report in a broader political context. We can get into details in the panel discussion about what it says about development, the state of development, the state of compliance with the Paris principles and the Accra Agenda for Action. As Homi indicated, back in 2005 and then in 2008, the development community decided on what some fundamental principles should be related to development and related to the quality of the partnership. This evolved from a longer effort to develop thinking in this area, and I still I am not succeeding in trying to get people to stop using the word aid, but I can tell you only that in the 1990s we thought we'd dispensed of the word. The word to me connotes charity, and it seems to have created a perception that it's simply a technical mechanism for transferring resources. It has always been much more than that, but at its core it's about establishing trust and a willing partnership with developing countries. And at its core, it is always meant that we need to be listening as much as we are talking in that relationship. Now, the reason I talk about the evolution from aid to development cooperation is because I think that is kind of the story behind the data that will be distributed to you today in this report. And I give want to recognize Brenda Killen. Where is she? She's there. Her team has been working on this for a long time. I think the number of countries that have participated in this survey is an indication of a changed world with respect to development. In the end, 78 surveys came in from developing countries, actually more, but 78 were of a quality that we could use in this analysis. They were close to 90 in the end. That is so much greater than what happened in Paris or in Accra. And I think it is fair to say, and developing countries would have every right to say, that the Paris process was driven by development ministries of the developed world, the donor ministries. Now, it was also informed by almost 50 years of experience working in the field with partners who I think we came to the realization if they didn't succeed, then USAID wouldn't succeed or DFID wouldn't succeed. And so Paris did adopt these principles that have proven to be sound. There was an earlier evaluation that we released about a month ago that took a select group of countries that proved empirically that when these principles of ownership and alignment and transparency and accountability for results were applied, that in fact we were able to achieve development results. Now, the story is always mixed. Every relationship is different, every country. Not every country has become what is now called a developmental state. And there are many fragile countries that, frankly, do not have the capacity to be developmental states yet. But if there is a leadership such as that we see from people like Minister Pires, many more will become developmental states. And there are two reports that are issued today. One is on fragile states and the other is on the other countries that that were surveyed. I think the story is not, as Paul O'Brien said earlier today in a meeting, one of crisis. It is not a happy, an entirely happy story for donor nations, because it's quite clear that they have not fully complied with what they agreed to do in Paris. But it's a very happy story to see that developing nations have created systems that enable them to determine their own destiny. That is what is so significant about this. So it's a story of progress and a story of shortfall. The question then is, how can we accentuate the progress, and how can we compensate for the shortfall? Obviously, Busan is our opportunity to do both. But I suppose as a DAC chair, I should probably offer some mitigating circumstances on behalf of the donors. As I mentioned before, many of the donor nations are represented by development ministries that are quite experienced. They live in the field. They understand poverty. They understand their partners, for the most part. You will always find stories that contradict that, but for the most part, the missions that exist in the field know their business. I recall very vividly in the 1990s when I was participating as a representative of the United States at the Development Assistance Committee, getting together with a few of the development ministers and saying, we need to decide what our goals are. It is not enough to simply measure our volume. a volume doesn't tell the whole story. It tells a very important part of the story, but not all. So let's look at some of the UN agreements that have been reached. Let's try to determine what the goals of the development community are. And we, after 2 years of discussions and negotiation and some really good people helping us write this report, we put out the Shaping the 21st Century report, the goals for the development community. That report, within a year, was endorsed by the G8 and later became basically the Millennium Development Goals. So the problem was, until the G8 endorsed it and then the United Nations, that the report was fundamentally coming from development ministries. I'll never forget the discussion prior to going to the G8 when the Treasury Department here and the State Department, I guess I'm not revealing any secrets, said, we can't endorse this. We can't have the presidents of the G8 endorse this report. We never even saw it, which was true. It took some real leadership on the part of then leader of DFID, the Secretary of State for Development of the UK, Clare Short, basically to threaten to go public and say, you did endorse this through your aid administrator, and that's what's important. Well, it was adopted by the G8, but I guess my point is this: simply this. We have made too many international agreements that only are undertaken by the development ministries. That's too narrow. We need the entire authority of government behind these agreements. And when we go to Busan, we want to see a much higher level of participation on the part of governments. And I'm absolutely delighted to see that Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has now announced that she will be coming to Busan. I can't tell you how significant that is, because it's going to attract others. We know that the UN Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon, will be there. And my expectation is that we will get very high-level representation, and that there will be a political declaration coming out of Busan that will have even more meaning than the outcome document that is being worked on assiduously by the Working Party, which is a highly representative Working Party representing the developing world as much as all of the major institutions, including multilateral organizations of the developed world. But as we go to Busan, we will have more people and important institutions being influenced by the evidence than ever before, because this survey is one of a kind. It's never been undertaken before. And you can quibble about the methodology. Were the indicators that were selected the right ones? But the fact of the matter is, they're very, very revealing. When I say that there has been great progress, take a look at this report to see what countries have done to create systems, statistical systems, coordination units, the capacity to plan, the capacity to develop their own strategic strategies, basically, for development. I can remember in the 1990s there were a handful of countries that really started asking really difficult questions about what aid agencies were doing in their country. One that strikes me as being the epitome of ownership, which is one of the key significant factors here, was President Konare of Mali. He wanted to know initially where all of the money on HIV/AIDS was being spent in his country. And when he found out, he said, that's just wrong. And then he asked where other sectors, where people were spending money within other sectors. And before long, he had a comprehensive understanding of what others were doing in his country. And he began to own his own program. Then we could see results. I think anyone who's been involved in this business understands that you can't achieve results unless there is that kind of buy-in that kind of ownership on the part of countries. I've heard Talat mention many times, you can take people out of a country and you can send them off for a two-week vacation to be trained to do X, Y, or Z. But that doesn't transform an institution. That simply gives people an opportunity for a very nice vacation. And we've finally learned these lessons. We have learned them. And developing countries have learned, too, that they cannot possibly achieve development results unless they own their own strategies. This report will show that a good deal of progress has been made in developing countries, but the focus should be on the shortfalls. It should be on the fact that some $10 billion of our approximately $130 billion that's being spent by the DAC in 2010, that number may go down or it may certainly level off, is still tied. The transaction costs we now know of tied aid are extraordinary. It will show that the donors have not been as predictable as they need to be if, in fact, we're going to effectuate ownership on the part of developing countries. If a country receiving American aid, for example, doesn't know what is going to be coming forward a year from now or 2 years from now or 5 years from now, how can it possibly plan? We should have an obligation, understanding that there are caveats because of the separation of power system here. There have to be caveats, but we should do a much better job of providing in a transparent way what we are going to be giving to that country over a period of time. We all know that there are pipelines that are created. We all know that there's an annual appropriations process, but the fact of the matter is we can do so much better in being predictable. We also need, in a partnership with countries, whether it's through a budget support or sector support, to understand what our joint goals are. What is it we expect to achieve? And are there benchmarks along the way? We've done some of that work back in the 1990s at USAID. But I think what I'm saying is that there are constraints beyond what the development ministries would like to do. Biggest constraint in the United States is the procurement process. I've failed in 6.5 years to do much about it. And I really commend Raj Shah for having the guts to use the waiver as much as he has been doing. To try to improve the procurement system. We cannot continue to basically send as many contractors. We cannot fail to see the talents that already exist in the developing world and use those talents. We hear now from the developing countries that this is unacceptable behavior. I'm amazed to learn, it just sort of drives home the point. In 2010, the United States made 1,456 missions to 61 developing countries. France, 928 missions to 46 countries. Japan, 509 to 70 countries. Were all those missions necessary? When you think about the ministries of these countries who are supposed to be working on development, spending their time trying to satisfy a delegation coming in from another country, have we harmonized? Absolutely not. We can't seem to find a common auditing procedure that all of the donor nations can use so that there's at least one instead of 35. It seems to me that these are not insurmountable problems, that we can find solutions if we have the political will. And that's why it's so significant to say, all right, we all know that the development mission is in one way more vital than ever before because you cannot solve the global problems we face, whether they be financial or security, or whether they be health or education or food, price volatility, or the need for infrastructure. We can't solve any of these problems that the G20 is now addressing without effective development. And yet, knowing that, we're not willing to make the changes that are reflected in this report. That's outrageous. It has to stop. And we need, therefore, to go to Busan with a whole-of-government attitude that we're going to make a commitment to this, to serve our own taxpayers, our own citizens, to serve the citizens of the developing world so that they can control their own destiny. I am absolutely convinced that Busan will be a success because we have a common agenda, and that is the global issues that I've mentioned before. Will we be successful in getting the Chinese and the Brazilians and the Indians and others that are the new providers of assistance? I think we will be, and one of the reasons I think we will be is because while they are very proud and should be of the relationships they've developed on a South-South basis, the fact of the matter is that they still have issues related to the effectiveness of their own programs. Even if their own programs are based on a narrower interest than just development, I mean, frankly, let's be fair, everyone's interests are not that narrow. They're broader, and they include other types of aspects of the relationship. But to the extent they want to achieve development effectiveness, they can't be unaware that the power relationship they have, let's say China with Timor, if you're talking about security or trade or other issues, China will always dominate. But if it's China saying we want Timor to be successful in development, they need to find an equal platform on which to stand. They need to say, your success is our success. And so they have to overcome the fact that there is a power differential. And that's why I think they will come to Busan with a new understanding that this is a global endeavor and that they need global solidarity to achieve that purpose. They've done some very interesting work in recent years, and I'm very proud that China and the DAC have had an extended study group going on for over 2 years now, especially focusing on what we're doing in Africa. And we have learned from the Chinese with respect to how they have reduced poverty, and I believe they've learned from us, and we both learn from the African nations. So there's a great deal of optimism that I have today. I believe that the story that we have to tell in this evidence that we're providing you today is instructive. It has caused Busan to become a vehicle for the developing world to express their desire for control of their own destiny. That's the political message. Hillary Clinton has heard it, and she is going to be there. Ban Ki-moon has heard it, and he's going to be there. And I think it's very significant. Gender will be an issue there as well. And that's significant. But the fact that the United Nations is there and the person of the Secretary General should answer any of the questions anyone might have as to whether this Busan conference is too narrowly defined. This is a world global conference, and the world will be watching very, very closely. We're all well aware of the economic problems that we face. We can no longer satisfy ourselves with modalities such as North-South, South-South, donor, recipient. We need to begin the process of erasing those words and creating a new world for development. Thank you very much.
Brian, thank you very, very much indeed. That was a wonderful statement. Let me ask the other panelists to please come up on stage. And as they're getting set, let me quickly introduce them. So first, I'm really pleased that we have the current Minister of Finance of Timor-Leste, Emilia Pires. She is currently, in addition to being the Minister of Finance, she is the chair of the G7 Plus, a group of 17 of the world's most fragile states that have come together to talk about the very particular issues that arise in thinking about development cooperation in the context of fragile states. Simultaneously with her role as the chair of the G7 Plus, Ms. Pires is also the co-chair of the International Dialogue on Peace Building and State Building, a group which includes donors as well as fragile states, to have a joint discussion on this. Next to her is Brenda Killen. Brenda is the author of the one of the her team is the author of the report that you've just heard presented to you. She is at the OECD. She is the chief of the division that deals with aid effectiveness. She is the person who is responsible for preparation of the Busan high-level forum and providing a lot of the secretariat support for that process. Next to her is Talat Abdel-Malek. He is the economic advisor to the Minister of International Cooperation for Egypt. But perhaps for these purposes, more importantly, since 2008, he has been the co-chair of the OECD DAC Working Party on Aid Effectiveness. He's been the chair of the monitoring and evaluation team of the UN Development Assistance Framework for Egypt, chair of the steering committee of the Cairo Agenda for Action, and until July of 2009, also a full professor of development and international economics at the American University in Cairo. And last but not least, at the end of the platform is Paul O'Brien. Since 2008, Paul has been the vice president for policy and campaigns at Oxfam America. Before that, he was based in Afghanistan as the senior international advisor to create the Afghanistan Interim National Development Strategy and the Afghanistan Compact. He worked for CARE International as the Afghanistan Advocacy Coordinator and has been co-founder of the Legal Resources Foundation in Kenya and founded the Human Rights Research and Advocacy Consortium in Afghanistan as well. So I think you will agree with me that we've got a wonderful panel. So to start the discussion, Emilia, I'd like to start from you with you, because at the end of the day, all of this agenda on aid effectiveness is really about getting better results on the ground. And, you know, East Timor has had plenty of experiences with donors, presumably some of them good and some of them bad. I wonder if you'd like to tell us a little bit about specific examples of what you see as being good practices of donors on the ground and bad practices with respect to some of these Paris principles.
Okay. What can I say? I'm a result-oriented person. And if you look back to Timor-Leste, we've had assistance since 1999. Now, it's been reported that from 1999 to 2006-07, that there were about $8 billion that went into my country. But then if you look at the results at that time, what happened? We had a crisis. We had 150,000 IDPs, internal displaced people. we had two main institutions for security, the defense and the army, and the police fighting each other. Gangsters of youth and poverty increased from to nearly 50%, and the economy contracted. So these are facts, and I, unfortunately, when I say this to development partners, it doesn't, they don't react very well. But the problem is that that's what it is. And then we came into government in 2007 in the middle of this crisis. Now, the first thing I did within Ministry of Finance was trying to restructure the Ministry of Finance by asking for an ideal Ministry of Finance. And then what I did is when it came to the aid effectiveness unit, I kind of did not put it in the right place. It should be within the budget directorate. But I put it outside, directly under me. And so some senior advisor says, "But why are you doing that? It doesn't make sense." I said, "Well, look around and see who in my ministry can actually handle the donors. The donors will just override them all. But with me, it will be a bit of a problem because I will fight back and I will not let them do this." So what the, now I look back listening to you, Brian, it is what you call the strong leadership, that there has to be strong leadership in the country. Otherwise, you tend to say yes. And this was happening in my country as well, because and how I handled trying to empower other ministers, because I saw them always complaining, "Oh, the donors want to do this, etc., and we really cannot depend on them because they promise and then they don't deliver, and then my programs don't take off." And then they wanted to ask for money from the state budget, and that's where I came into the picture. And I said, "No, I'm not going to give it to you, because clearly you were supposed to receive $10 million from this donor, and he tells me that you have, so I'm going to cut yours and give it to somebody else." So all hell broke loose. So this empowered my colleagues to actually say no or yes to the donors, to be strong. And then with that the stronger leadership, donors started to come into line. Because at the end of the day, they want to do something. And they do take advantage if you are weak. And this is what I said to my other colleagues. But I have to be careful here, because Timor-Leste has its own money. So I could afford, if the donor turned back, I could go back to my budget and cover. The others don't have it. So the responsibility is bigger for the donors then. Because what happens is you intimidate the ministers. They will not say it because they're scared that something will happen. And it happened to me as well. You know, when I took on the IMF, everybody knows about IMF, right? Nobody wants to take them on. And then, and I did, because they, after many hours in my country, they wrote a report completely different. And I said, "What's going on in here? What happened?" And so I said, "You're not going to publish this report. I'm going to withdraw myself from IMF. And so we started to fight. But then there was when they started to kind of become heavy-handed with me, I kind of became a bit scared too. So I ring up my prime minister. I said, "Prime minister, I'm having a fight here with the IMF. And what happens now? Because if they do whatever they do, what if they damage the country? What if I put Timor-Leste, something will happen because they have so much power around the world." So prime minister goes, "Listen, you know, back in 75, everybody ignored us. Do you believe in what you're doing?" I said, "Yes, of course. That's why I'm fighting them. So stick to your guns." And so I stuck to my guns, and IMF fired the person that did mess, you know, messed up in my country, and put somebody else who understood better. So again, goes back to, are we strong enough and courageous enough to actually say no to the development partners? Now, when you look back, I mean, after all these things, the relationship did not deteriorate. Actually, the donors in my country appreciated, because we are honest, and now they are honest with us as well. We sit on the table, and we put it on the table, the truth. Because at the end of the day, it's people. We're dealing with people. I look and I say, that is a person. He has a brother, a sister, a father, a mother. He's not this big, huge thing. And maybe he misunderstood. He doesn't understand my situation. I have to articulate it, and I do. And then they try to understand. And if we don't understand each other, we say, okay, you take your money and go somewhere else. I go to another one. And it goes on, you know, like this type of thing. So there are many, many behaviors. And I hope it's all documented. I haven't read the report. Ah, another thing is the Paris Declaration. I only became aware of it in 2008, that there was targets, that there was all this. So you guys, or the donors, they agree on these things, but we in the country, we don't know anything about it. We don't know what we are being measured against. We don't even know that this existed. So when I found out about the Paris Declaration, I started to look at it, and I go, wow, these are beautiful words, and this is exactly what we like. Ownership, alignment, harmonization, predictability, results. Who doesn't like it? So the problem is implementation. It doesn't happen. You go around, you can sell it. It's like, and I know, like when I did National Development Plan for Timor-Leste before, and I tell you, all the documents that came from the donors said it is in line with the development, you know, national development plan. But then they continue to do whatever they want because it's just wording, you know. And so now I've learned the lesson. I go straight into, no. You know, it's like results, specifically. If it's not happening, you didn't do it. It's not aligned. It's not in a harmonization, tarara, you know, that type of thing. You really need to be specific enough. So I don't want to take too much of your time because, like, there's lots and lots of stories.
Thank you. That's it. Wonderful dose of reality. So, Brenda, let's stay with this theme of power relations. Brian talked about power relations. Do you see any evidence that this process has been more effective in countries which have stronger leadership and the more aid-dependent countries, perhaps? Timor-Leste, thankfully, was not in a situation of being aid-dependent in terms of having their own budgetary resources. Do you see any evidence that this has worked better in countries which are not aid-dependent? And maybe I can just go a little bit further on that. Brian mentioned that you now have 78 countries that responded to this survey. I mean, that seems to me to be quite a lot. Are you pleased? Do you think that this process has itself empowered many developing countries to take more control over their own development destiny?
Thank you. In starting with the last question first, I think, yes, this process has enabled countries to take more control. I think, as Mr. Pires said, writing something down so that there's a set of principles gives anyone an ability to stick to their guns, to be able to say no. And the very fact that over the 6 years of this process, we've gone from 34 countries in the original survey to 55 in the survey that we held in 2008 to 78. And indeed more, as Brian said, more have actually started the process, but only 78 were able to report by the time for this edition of the survey. We hope that in the next edition we might be able to get that number up higher. And that accounts for about 75% of official development assistance. So that's a significant sample. The fact that countries have voted with their feet and done this shows that it's valuable to them in and of itself, the survey process. And I think one of the most empowering aspects of the survey process is the discussion that takes place in every country when the results come in. Definitely an empowering process for the country because everyone is held to account who has achieved what they said they were going to do, and then a discussion around why that hasn't happened. And especially in some of the countries where we can see that the countries themselves have done more to tackle the targets to make progress in the direction of the targets than their partners have done. It's in a way that's turning the tables from the usual type of discussion. The first point that you asked about whether this relationship is correlated with whether countries are aid dependent or not, interestingly, that isn't the case. And I think, again, some of the phrases that you just used, Minister Pires, about countries actually standing up and taking control, that really comes through from the survey. It also really comes through from the independent evaluation of the Paris Declaration. And I'd encourage those of you who haven't read that to have a look at some of the case studies in there. But countries, whether they were aid dependent or not, countries who've had the strength or the vision to say, this is the basis on which we do business with donors, and to take the framework of the Paris Declaration, to use that to frame their strategies for managing aid, link that to their national development strategies, and then stand up and negotiate with donors on that basis. That really is strongly linked with progress on development. And so we have examples of countries like Rwanda or Mozambique, countries which are receiving large amounts of aid, but they have put in place very strong processes for managing their donors, and the Paris Declaration has really helped to support that.
Thank you. Talat, let me move on to you. It's, you know, you're co-chair of the Working Party on Aid Effectiveness and the representative voice, if you like, of the developing countries. What do you think developing countries are most pleased about in terms of this, the results achieved on the Paris process, and what do you think they're most disappointed with in terms of what has not happened?
Well, developing countries have every right to be pleased about a number of things. I've been involved in this process, at least officially, since 2005. And I have seen a number of countries and visited a number of countries and worked on the ground in my own country, Egypt, to see that some countries really leapt forward in terms of ownership. In many countries, when I talk to their representatives today, they're no longer doing the survey in order to satisfy a commitment they have made in Paris or in Accra. They're doing it for their own self-interest. And I think this is a quantum leap. They don't need the Paris Declaration. They don't need the AAA. They would not even need Bosin to remind them of the importance of doing a better job managing their national development. We are no longer talking about managing aid. And I think you have to be, to put your ears close enough to the ground to realize the subtle but fundamental transformation that is taking place not only on the level of policymakers, but senior bureaucrats. I cannot emphasize that enough. So that's one. And for that, of course, partner countries are thankful for the Paris process to have, I do not want to go as far as saying initiated that, but to have accelerated the awareness that they have got to take charge of their own development. International institutions can only help. Bilateral development partners can only help. But in the final analysis, it is their primary responsibilities to take charge of their own future. So that's one. Two, the monitoring survey, as you have said, as Brian has said, has provided partner countries, as well as their development partners, with the richest body of data, concrete data, on which we have benefited, we have learned, we have compared experiences. But while I agree with what Brenda said, that the rise in the number of countries that participated in the survey is a very good indication of their commitment, I think more and more partner countries are saying that detailed and comprehensive survey has served its purpose. It is time to shift gear to something much more strategic because it is time-consuming. We're talking about transaction costs. The transaction costs of the survey work, and ask me, being a national coordinator for the last 6 years in Egypt, has been horrendous, absolutely horrendous. I'm not talking about financial costs. I'm talking about something much more valuable. How to coordinate 33 government ministries, most of whom are at the receiving end of some form of aid, maybe some of them not more than $1 million, okay? But yet, they are required to fill out these forms, to give us details, to validate data, and then you're dealing with 24 to 28 development partners in Egypt. And the last thing they want is to fill out more forms in the kind of detail. And then we go back to them and say, listen, joint missions, there is double count here. So you need to give us the two lists, and we will try to coordinate. So I think the time has come for us to take a fresh look, to forget about comprehensive monitoring. That is not to dismiss the rich body of data, which are still useful, but to strategize. And this is going to be one of the challenges that we will have to face in Busan, and we're doing some interesting work. Now, the countries are also taking pride in initiating mutual accountability mechanisms. Many people scoffed at that a few years ago. Now it is partner countries that are pushing their development partners to sit around the same table and to stop finding excuses that they are not qualified, that they don't have the database, and so on. We are saying, if you're serious, let us do that together. Let us build a more effective information base, more transparent. It takes two to tango. So stop pointing the fingers at us. Right. Now, what are most partner countries displeased with? The snail's pace of behavioral change on most development partners. It has become embarrassing. And it is high time that our development partners, and I don't want to overgeneralize because some have initiated some very interesting changes. I do not want to name names here. But most have talked the good talk, but have not started walking yet. And so I think one of the big challenges in Busan will be to make a very concrete set of commitments that are measurable and that are monitorable there. Otherwise, there is going to be a backlash, and I promise you that. There is going to be a huge backlash from partner countries. Everybody is keeps talking about the importance of mutual trust. Well, the key word is mutual. One-way trust never works. And so it is time for development partners to come up to the level of trust that we expect and that we respect. The jury is still out on that one. Mm-hmm. There are other things, but I think these are the strategic thing, positives and negatives. Of course, one final comment here is that we're looking forward very much to engaging the so-called new partners who are really not new. It's a shame to call China, with 6 years' history of aid, a new partner. But let's say somebody who would join what we hope to be a global platform for managing and governing development cooperation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Paul.
Grace.
Earlier you said this really points to a system in crisis. Of course, the NGO community, I mean, you have boots on the ground in so many different countries. It's you're perhaps much closer to where development really happens than people sitting in the capital cities of developing countries. What do you hear about how all of this is being implemented, whether it's making a difference or not, and what do you look for in Busan?
Okay, so let me get to that, but let me say a little bit why I called it a crisis. I still think it's a crisis after listening to everyone now, but I want to put it a little bit in context and hopefully provoke a bit of discussion. First, congrats on the report. I do think it's exactly what we need. It's fair, it's balanced, it's detailed, it's got lots of data in there, and it provokes discussion, which is exactly what we would want from the OECD. But let's remember sort of why we got into this whole discussion in the first place. We, in 2005, recognized that, once and for all, we were never going to have enough aid to solve these global problems. We needed to have effective states managing their own affairs. That was where we were seeing real progress, whether it was on their own social issues or more broadly elevating economic growth. It was when states were acting effectively and when aid was used to stimulate states or incentivize states to be more effective that it was at its best. So we made this big deal. We said to developing countries, you get your collective acts together or your individual acts together, you get more effective, and we'll trust you more. That was the whole basis of the deal. Here's the story I heard today. They've done a decent job. They're making progress against a lot of the indicators. They're getting their individual and collective acts together. That was the good news you heard from all the panelists. Here's the bad news. We don't trust them more. 13 indicators were to be measured for progress by 2010. How many did we succeed on? One on the donor side. We've made progress on one. You know what the one was? Talking better to each other. That's where we are showing our collective trust in developing countries. So I think there's a crisis. I think the crisis is we didn't ante up as donors in terms of trust. Now, I have to say, I spent a lot of time working with USAID colleagues. It's not there that the problem is. As I agree with Brian. It's not in the development agencies. They got into the whole game because they started from the basis of trust. Most of them were former Peace Corps or whatever. Or, they started with the overseas experience. They start from a position of trust. That's why they're at USAID or at MCC or wherever. And they're making huge progress. I was just talking to Lip beforehand. He's off to do 10 different assessments about whether their countries are actually implementing country systems. And I know Steve is doing an awful lot on the aid effectiveness stuff. USAID is doing piles of stuff to try, within the political constraints they face, to use tools to demonstrate more trust. But the problem is, Brian's exactly right. In this town and in many towns, particularly in Europe now, if you are going to get anywhere in building real trust so that you can go out there to countries and make long-term commitments and you can use their systems and not be scared about the first whiff of corruption, you have to have a whole-of-government approach. There has to be political leadership. And it has to be willing to do what the brave minister from Timor-Leste did, stick to their guns. Because you know there's going to be a battle in Congress. What if you walk into Congress today and say, you know, the only way we're ever going to get effective development in sub-Saharan Africa is to show 10 years of trust in these countries and let them lead. Give them our tax dollars and let them lead because we can't do it for them. You know what the more isolationist members of Congress are going to say. And it takes real political leadership to say it's still the only way to do it. So probably the best news, I do think it's great news that Secretary Clinton is going to go to Busan and put a bit of capital in there. And if she can both talk in the right ways there and talk to her boss about keeping global internationalism on the agenda and keeping global poverty on the agenda, I frankly wasn't thrilled with how much attention it got at the UNGA this week in President Obama's speech. I think he walked away from some of the brave things he said last year. I understand there's lots of other stuff going on, but he had the chance to start a global discussion and he didn't. If she doesn't show the leadership, if President Obama doesn't show leadership in keeping to the core deal, which was trusting these countries a little bit more and taking some risk, all the progress that they make in the end of the day is not going to make USAID more effective. So when they get to Busan, I hope they do see a little bit of crisis in the data that they got from this report, not in terms of where the developing countries are, but where they are themselves. And when it comes time, I hear they want to talk about three things: ownership, mutual accountability, and results. When they talk about results, they don't just have one of those self-congratulatory discussions about inputs and outputs on the results side, but they take the courageous view of what results are, which is far-sighted and the right results designed to make those countries more effective. when they talk about ownership. Everybody in this town seems to like ownership now, so there must be something wrong with the word. We've got to get back to what the underlying principle was, which is giving them power, real power, to manage their own affairs. Unless there is a discussion in Busan about what that transition in power is ultimately going to take from these donor countries, we're going to have a great rhetorical discussion, but it's not actually going to accelerate the debate at all. And the last thing I'll say, because I've been a little too nice to developing country governments in the comments that I've made, on the mutual accountability front, effective states, yes, we absolutely need them, but there's never been an effective state in history without ultimately an vibrant civil society that can hold them accountable, has the space to hold them accountable, and actually does that. So unless in Busan we have a serious discussion about what's going to keep those states effective, then whatever trust we show in them will probably be misplaced in the end of the day. So I actually am cautiously optimistic that the reason Secretary Clinton wants to go there is to make this a political moment, not just a technical moment. But it's going to take a lot of vision and courage on her part. And those of you who have the opportunity to influence what she's going to do and say there, I hope you take the time to do so.
Thank you. Well, Brian, let me at least give you an opportunity to respond to some of this before we open up the floor to Q&A. And what I hear is there's a real irony. You set up this process in some sense to have peer pressure put on donor countries that by making commitments together in a collective fashion, they would each be able to do more than what they had been able to do individually. And to some extent that's historically been one of the great powers of the DAC that you chair. And here you are, you go into this process, and it's the DAC part that doesn't seem to have worked so well. And it's the developing country part where there isn't this kind of peer pressure and other mechanisms that does seem to have worked well. So do you have any other instruments at your disposal to try to accelerate what Talat called a snail's pace of progress?
Well, I've only been there 6 months.
Well, I'm kind of eight.
I have some thoughts. Mm-hmm. If I revealed them today, I think probably I would foreclose some of them. But I think you guys can all watch and see whether or not in a year or two I get fired, because I'm elected to this position, by the way. So I think it's my job to hold the feet to the fire of our members, because, frankly, it's the members who have decided that that's what they want. And so there are a variety of ways of applying peer pressure. When we do peer reviews, for example, most of the good information we get are from the development ministries that are telling us, I can't do this because the finance ministry won't give me the authority to do this, or the parliament has said that we can't change the procurement laws or whatever. So we frankly find it very helpful to put these peer reviews. Last time I was here, it was the peer review on the United States, and sometimes, frankly, the politics overwhelm the peer review process. That may be the state of Washington today. It's a very dangerous time. I think we need leadership in the developed countries as badly as we need it in the developing countries. I wish Minister Pierce were here and serving in some capacity in the United States. Perhaps you could give some advice to the Congress. But when our countries are all suffering from poverty, the poverty index for the United States is higher. The Tea Party is coming. I forget. I live in Paris now. I'm not supposed to say things like that here in Washington. But the fact of the matter is that when the developed countries are seeing demographic changes, finance changes, economic changes, and then they see the middle-income countries, with 8 to 10% growth rates, it changes people's attitudes, and it's very significant to understand that it's part of the context. And we have to find a way to build ourselves out of that. I do think that events like Busan can be very helpful, but what we do to follow up on Busan could be even more helpful. And just to engage someone like Secretary Clinton in the process means that she will not only have an effect on what happens there, but when she comes out, what she hears there will have an effect on her. We need leaders like that can influence the world and not allow ourselves to begin to look at our feet all the time. We just have to begin to see our way out of the kind of crisis that we're in. We cannot ignore the people that have gone jobless for a year or two. We can't ignore that, but we have to also understand that the solutions only come from an interdependent world. I mean, if we don't create new markets in the developing world, then our slowly dying off population in the developed world will get nowhere. So these kinds of relationships, we have to begin to see that development cooperation is an investment in our future as much as it is in the future of the developing world. And I want to find political leaders that are willing to talk that way and to lead our people in the right direction.
Well, thank you. Today happens to be the first anniversary of the Presidential Policy Directive on Development, and so I do think that there are perhaps signs that certainly in the United States as well as in some other countries there is now more of a commitment to try to provide the kind of leadership that you're talking about, and of course those efforts will not be reflected as yet in the results of the Paris survey. Talat, you want to make an observation, and then I want to open it up to the floor.
To what Paul has said, I fully agree. Certainly, partner countries still have ways to go. But you talk about making government accountable through civil society, I would say, and parliamentarians.
Sure.
Which takes me to the point that foreign aid policies is part of the foreign policy of development partners. And I just spend a minute or two on the case of Egypt. Many of our development partners have explicitly or implicitly supported what turned out to be a repressive regime, with huge restrictions on the role of civil society, which was being accused of having received foreign funds, and the list of nonsense. And we ended up with a rubber stamp parliament. Now, just imagine, had the previous regime not received the kind of explicit support, financial and political, what would have happened to the situation in Egypt? We would have had a thriving civil society. We would have regained real parliamentary democracy that we had forgotten about for the best part of 50 years. So, again, we need to discuss development cooperation in a political context as well. And a big issue, a big challenge here, is for the major powers to stop supporting repressive regimes, because this is the way to make governments more truly accountable. Thank you.
Thank you. So we've got about 15 minutes left. Let me throw open the floor to questions.
Yeah, I'm John Coonrod with the Hunger Project, and I had a question of Professor Malik and also Minister Pires on other roles for civil society in partnership with country-owned development strategies beyond accountability, in terms of information gathering, capacity building, design, implementation of national development strategies on more of a campaign basis, getting beyond the bureaucratic approaches, and what you all have seen about that, because this, from a civil society perspective, has been one of the snailiest of the snail paces in this process, is understanding that country-led is not only government-led.
I'm going to take up three questions, if you could pass the mic to the lady.
Thank you. I'm Carolyn Long with Interaction, and we're the Coalition of U.S. NGOs, of which Oxfam is a member. Two major points. One is I spent the morning compiling feedback on the latest draft Busan outcome document, so I've been in the weeds with this morning. Two concerns. One is I would say we're very worried about the commitment of the donors to continuing the Paris Declaration and Accra commitments. The document, while it says that those who signed it will recommit themselves, there seems to be a real softening of the commitment. Harmonization and alignment aren't mentioned. The European Commission just came out with their statement about Busan and their waffling on the indicators. They want fewer indicators and so forth. So we understand bringing in the old new donors like China and others. We understand the importance of that. We support that, but we're worried about going forward with the Paris and Accra declarations. And on that point, I would say in July at the working party, I was very taken with the comments by several African governments who were asked about this, who were, I thought, making a plea to continue this process now that they were really into it and getting some real value out of it. And we know it's embarrassing for the donors that they haven't done well, but they should still go forward. That's one thing. The second point is we in civil society are worried about two things. One is the very shrinking space for a civil society to operate around the world. Since the Paris Declaration was signed, we feel that governments have used the policy, the principle of country ownership as state ownership, and the space has closed in many, many authoritarian countries and not so authoritarian. We're very worried about that because we can't operate and go forward with our own accountability, which we have improved over the last 3 years through our Istanbul principles and our new framework, unless we have an enabling environment. And the second thing is, country ownership must be viewed as inclusive democratic ownership in order, as Paul says and as you all agreed, that countries be held accountable, governments be held accountable to their people. So I'd appreciate some comments on that.
Thank you. I'll take one more from the front, and then I'll come back to right here on the right-hand side, this lady. Did you have your hand up?
I'm Nuria Molina, Director of the European Network on Debt and Development. I wanted to raise a couple of questions regarding what Brian described as...
One question.
Okay, two sub-questions of one point, which is what Brian described as one of the biggest constraints in donor countries, procurement policies. Clearly, unlocking the constraints that we have in developing countries with regards to, for instance, procurement policies is very much up to the parliament, to finance ministries. How do we engage these levels of government, which is really where the problems are, not so much in development agencies, development ministries? More than half the aid given every year, it's actually awarded, given in procurement contracts, and most of it, the vast majority of these procurement contracts, according to a new research that we have done at IRDAT, it's awarded to rich country companies. There's many problems around this issue, among them the issue that has been mentioned of tight aid, the issue of country systems. We know that there's very little progress in country systems. But one particular issue, I think, which is particularly relevant is that actually in Accra and in Paris, donors agreed to use increasingly country systems in a change for the recipients actually improving these country systems. They have improved, but actually donors have not improved. And donors have been given technical advice, which actually has not helped. We looked at procurement in the European Union in an internal market which is fully liberalized, and actually 98% of the contracts in European Union countries go to local companies. But the type of advice that we are giving to recipient countries is to completely liberalize their procurement systems and go for international competitive bidding, which actually is helping these countries go to donor country companies instead of making use of the aid as a way to boost local economies and the local talents, as Brian was saying. What can we do about it? What can we do to make that aid actually goes to developing countries and doesn't flow back to rich country companies, and it only goes to developing countries on the books but not in practice?
Okay, thank you. I'm going to try to allocate the questions, if I may, to hopefully give us time to have one more round. So, Brian, would you like to start with the question on procurement and use of country systems? And there is a specific measure on improvement of procurement in the survey.
Well, it is a very difficult question, and I don't come at it from the history of success in my own tenure. I have to say, in the case of the United States, of course, the procurement laws are for every department of government. You could be buying a missile defense system with the same procurement laws that you're buying an aid project. And that's why I think it's very, very important. If people in the U.S. Congress take seriously the Government Results and Performance Act, which they passed, then they will begin to focus on how one achieves results in various departments of government. What that would imply is that there needs to be specialized procurement laws in the Foreign Aid Agency. That is going to take leadership. It's going to take Paul Oxfam or others here in this group interaction, Carolyn, to make that a part of their objective here in terms of trying to get these changes made. But, you know, there are so many other things I know you're focusing on that it's hard to do that. And it's not sexy, but it has such an impact. So the procurement laws of the European Union, of the United States, or whatever, should reflect the Paris principles. And again, one of the real contradictions in this report is that developed countries, donors, are not taking advantage of country systems where they exist. The irony, there's several ironies in this. They're going to countries where there is a greater risk and putting, maybe because of historic reasons, putting more of their resources there, and they're not rewarding. So the system isn't kind of a market-based system where the rewards go to the countries that have already done the reform. Well, we need to pay more attention to that. We need to put that under a microscope and make sure that people understand that. And let's let laws like the Government Performance and Results Act, let's tell that story. When I was at USAID after about 3 years, we finally got an award from, I think, George Mason University for the best report to Congress under the Government Results and Performance Act, because we wanted the Congress to hold us accountable for results as opposed to simply worrying about inputs to the system. You know, the problem is that one committee of Congress is responsible for the Results Act, and the other, the appropriations committees, are the only ones that care about the foreign aid bill. I mean, this is a big problem in this city, that the authorization committees haven't been able. And I give Howard Berman great credit for pushing for a new Foreign Assistance Act. They badly need that here. But it should include some aspect of procurement reform. It may be more complicated with the council that governs the European Commission. I don't know. But people who care ought to take this issue up, because it will do more to help countries like Timor-Leste than a lot of the things we could do.
Thank you. Minister Pires, would you like to comment a little bit on the role that civil society played in Timor-Leste?
Well, our civil society in Timor-Leste is very active. And sometimes we say, okay, why do we need the parliament? And if you are taking over. But I have no problems with civil society, but in fragile state, we need to look at that, because you have fragile government, and then sometimes there is the pros and the cons. Okay, the cons would be you have a fragile government, and then you have donors, because they suspect, for some reason, you are a government, everybody suspects you. Everybody thinks you are corrupt. Everybody thinks something is wrong because you are a government of a third world poor country. I say this because it happened to me. First, I was working with the World Bank, the UN. I was like a very nice person, very full of integrity and stuff like that. Then the moment I become a minister of finance of a third world country, everybody's looking at me like, oh, she must be corrupt or something, stupid. Or, no, this is so serious. It happened to me. And I fought hard, and now, of course, now we are all okay again. But you have to fight. Now, so civil society, when the donors, they strengthen them very strong, but then the government is not very strong. And I see this in some of my colleagues in other G7 plus countries. It's not that people are against civil society, but you need to have a balance. And anyway, in Timor-Leste, we managed. Okay, we were very weak at the beginning, but we managed. To now we are on our fourth year and fifth year, and so we've actually managed to kind of fulfill our mandate. Next year we have elections. What we did is we started to work on systems. From Minister of Finance, I did this transparency portal. So I put all the budget in there because there was people screaming and we don't know what you're doing with the money and this and that, etc. Well, I didn't know what we were doing with the money either because there was no systems in place. But finally, I put the system in place, and now everybody knows what we're doing with the money down there. And then I said to the donors and to the civil society, transparency is not just for government. Transparency is for all of us, all of us. And then I get texts and says, oh, minister, you can't do that. We're just NGOs. It's very hard to build a country. I go, come on, you know? Like, so there is the pros and the cons. But I wanted to say something about the procurement laws, because right now, at the moment, I'm going through a reform of my procurement law, and that's been a lengthy process. We have like 13 pieces of legislation. We keep changing things, and one good thing about Timor-Leste is that when we see a mistake and we see it doesn't work, we change it. And that's the kind of government we have led by the Prime Minister, because he just wants things to work. He wants results, sometimes too fast, but still we get it. But now, in the background, we've been doing this process of changing the procurement law, and we left it in the hands of a small group with some international advisors, etc. And then they came back and they go, oh, now the European Commission and this and that, they want to give feedback. And I go, whoa, wait a minute, what feedback? Oh, because they want to improve the law. I said, improve my law? You first improve your law. And I said that to my advisors. I said, you tell them that I said so. But then they said it in a nice way. And then they go, but you have to have these international standards. I go, what international standards? The World Bank international standards. I go, I'm sorry, that's out of the windows. It doesn't work. And I say it, it doesn't work. And I will say it again and again. It doesn't work, therefore I'm not taking it. It's my money, I will do my procurement laws, and it's working in in Timor. Call me whatever names you want to call it, but my people are participating in the development of the nation. We may make mistakes, but we fix it on the dot. We don't have this tied business. And I had a discussion with the European Commission. They were going to help me do my building. And so we sat down and they go, yeah, but, you know, it has to go to a European company. I go, what? They are the most expensive ones. They are so far away. I've got cheaper companies out here in the region. It could be an Indonesian. It could be a Chinese. Everybody's scared of China. I'm not sure why. Really. Every time we do something with China, all hell breaks loose. Really. We bought some things from China because they were the cheapest. They were the fastest. We just used the same kind of commercial decisions that all the other countries do. There were all these things in the media as if we were getting together with China to invade somebody else's country. I don't know. And China doesn't even treat us as special. We went to China. China says, we will treat you the same as we treat everybody. That's it. They say, we'll treat you just as one-to-one. So no big special things. Now, my advice, Brian, you know, like I was listening. If you want to bring the BRICS in, you really need to clean up the house. Nobody's going to go and join the club when the club is not working. I'm telling you, if I was China, I wasn't going to come in. Because why should I? And you're telling me that I am the one who's not coordinated? Coordinate first with what you have already. Then they may come in. But otherwise, you will not win on this one. I can tell you. Sorry.
Be honest.
Brenda, moving quickly. There was a comment that maybe there's a softening of donors' commitments in the outcome document. Any reassurance that actually the new Busan outcome document will still keep donors' feet to the fire?
Well, just to say that, and certainly following that discussion at the working party, it came over very clearly that everybody there was saying we keep Paris and Accra. And so the way that the co-chairs, and in fact one of the co-chairs is sitting next to me here, the way that we've drafted the outcome document is to say it's taken as read that Paris and Accra, for those that endorse Paris and Accra, they stay as the standards that have to be met. But we don't then repeat what's in Paris and Accra in the Busan document, because as well the working party said we want a document that's short and political and to the point. But the message is definitely that those who endorse Paris and Accra will continue to meet those commitments. And then in addition, there's a number of new areas where further commitments are stated in the outcome document. And then there's calls to new partners who hopefully will endorse what comes out of Busan to show how they will move in the direction of the core principles of Paris. So I think that what you're saying, I suppose, rings alarm bells, because it wasn't intended that the outcome document would be seen as a softening. So I guess I can turn to Brian here, and I think it's essential that the DAC makes it clear, as one of the major groups that have endorsed Paris and Accra, that they go to Busan still committed to meeting those commitments, and in addition will go further in the areas that are in the outcome document. But I just want to make that statement very, very clear, that there's no softening of Paris and Accra, that Busan is additional to what's agreed there.
That's certainly a consensus of DAC members. There's no question about that. Even despite this survey.
Talat, so many questions about moving towards a whole-of-society approach in terms of country ownership. But one of the problems with civil society has always been who actually represents them. And certainly in a country like Egypt, where you don't have formal institutions, representative institutions, surely this is a difficult process. Now, I know that you've been having a series of national dialogues in Egypt. Any advice on how to engage with civil society a little bit more?
We can actually do with some advice, but just respond to the question of civil society. I think civil society, we have 24,000, okay, but probably less than 200 are really active and doing some developmental work. So challenge number one is to change legislation to make it far less restrictive and to couch it in different words that, you know, there's a partnership between government, civil society, and parliament. These are the key stakeholders. This has got to be embedded in a legislation. We're not there yet. Okay? And there are, of course, reactionary forces right now at work in Egypt, remnants of the previous regime and so on. I don't want to get into that. So we still have a way to go. Secondly, civil society needs capacity development. Their claim to fame has been how quickly they can put their hands in their donors' pockets. And I'm being perhaps a little bit uncharitable when I say that. Some are very professional. So the question of who would do the capacity development. I'm talking about local civil society, not international civil society. There is a tendency for international NGOs to use locals as subcontractors and, in fact, do what we tell you you need to do. This is very counterproductive. It doesn't build the capacity. It brings in a foreign agenda. It gives more ammunition to suspicious government officials who would point the finger. We need to reform that system. We need more transparency there. Now, civil society have got to have an association. They have been stopped from doing that. But I think this is the next step. My last comment about this is that I applaud the Istanbul Declaration, but I would caution about the continued use of the word independent civil society. That makes some government officials see red. You are part of the country. Yes, you are independent of government, but I would like to say, I would like to suggest that civil society will use a different language, less threatening language, so that there is a division of labor based on comparative advantages. Civil society is closer to the grassroots. They know the needs. So in terms of one of the aspects of your question, yes, they are in best position to gather real data, concrete and up-to-date data, okay, participate in the design of local projects, but I don't see civil society as participants in national planning at the strategic level, because simply they do not have the vision, they do not have the database to do that. I think their critical role is in implementation at the grassroots level, because they have competence far better than government, they're less bureaucratic, and critically, they have monitoring and accountability functions, which I would like to see emphasized. That would be my view. But that needs the development of a partnership between government and civil society. It's not going to happen until that genuine sense of partnership takes place.
Thank you. Paul, I'm going to give you the last word, and by that I literally mean the last word. In one sentence, tell us, what should civil society do beyond accountability, which Talat was just calling for? There was a question, surely they can do more. One sentence.
Thank God I know the art of a comma. My long...
Semicolons, please.
Understanding that the days of us providing government-funded parallel services to citizens is probably over, partly because of this whole Paris and aid effectiveness agenda. I think we do have a very important role to play, not just on accountability, but on deeply understanding what it means to help citizens become more active, to truly transfer capacity rather than just to engage in these capacity building workshops that sort of we tick them off. And what does it mean to leave behind? To become more local ourselves in identity as truly international organizations. And it'll only succeed if it is part of a broader understanding that in the end of the day, we're not the relevant actor in these situations. It's about the compact between a government and its people, and we can be useful in a whole range of fronts if we start with that humility, and we'll probably be irrelevant if we continue to think that we've much more to add beyond that.
Thank you so much. Forgive me for running on and not being able to take more questions. Please join me in thanking a really wonderful panel for this discussion.